Heaven knows what gave rise to that. Owls, ending those Elgar songs, Opus 53. And we heard Owls on its own there. Paul Spicer conducting the Finzi Singers.
This summer, dip in to the BBC Proms. Celebrate the golden age of the movies with John Wilson and his orchestra as they bring their signature style to some of Hollywood's greatest and most recognised themes. The BBC Proms, alive with music. The Hollywood Rhapsody Prom, Monday night at 7:30, live on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, and now we go back to the Royal Albert Hall to hear highlights of a Proms Plus late event recorded last Thursday in the Elgar Room. It's presented by Georgia Mann.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Late, which has a distinctly Eastern musical flavour. Glowing under the Elgar Room's purple-tinged lights are some beautiful Iranian instruments, a santur, which is an Iranian dulcimer, which will be played to us tonight by Thomas Brangwyn, a tonbak and an udu, percussion instruments, which Mehdi Ganjvar will be playing for us, and Adib Rassami will be playing the kemenche, which is the Iranian upright fiddle. Now, Thomas, who really put the band together for us tonight, first came across the santur at a chance encounter at a travelling circus, as he puts it, which I think is kind of brilliant. And he felt so in love with the instrument that he decided to master it come what may, never mind the fact that he didn't have a teacher, didn't know anybody who played it, and indeed didn't know where to find said santur. He managed to kind of overcome all those small details and become a real integral part of the thriving Iranian musical scene, and that's where he met Mehdi and Adib. And tonight they'll be playing for us traditional Persian music, but also some more contemporary stuff. And I know that there has even been some dulcimer dubstep from you before, Thomas, so look out for that. Providing the verse to accompany tonight's shimmering Persian soundtrack is a man whose poetry has been described as wonderfully searching and always compelling. Kayo Chingonye has read his work everywhere from the Big Chill Festival to Tate Modern. He represented Zambia, where he was born and spent the first 6 years of his life, at the South Bank Centre's Poetry Parnassus. And when he's not versifying, he's a hip-hop musician, creative writing teacher, and an events producer for the likes of Comic Relief and the British Council. He is a busy man. Kayo will be reading for us very soon. But first, music from Thomas Brangwyn, Mehdi Ganjvar, and Adib Rassami.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you. That was Pishtamarad Homayun and Chaha Mezrab Homayun. Thomas, can I ask you to uncross your legs and come and talk to me, please, or else I might plunge into your dulcimer face first with this microphone. Tell me a bit about this instrument, because you fell so in love with this at the travelling circus that you embarked on this crusade to master it, which I love the story of. But it's quite a small instrument. It's harp-like. It's a wooden soundboard, taut wires, rests flat like that. But it's got these tiny little sticks, which actually, of course, aren't called sticks. It's a big noise coming from the small delicacy. I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of tension. I've heard some people say over a ton of tension. And each note has four strings. And these sticks you grasp very tightly, and it all comes from the wrist, and it's a lot of power here that goes into it. The thing I like about this instrument in particular is it can be found in almost every culture of the world, actually. So I've played traditional English folk music and Hungarian and Romani Eastern European music on a cymbalum, which is a larger version, in most of Asia.
So culturally, it crops up everywhere.
Yeah, I think the Iranians, they are known as the creators, almost, of this instrument thousands of years ago, and it's travelled with civilizations all over the world, and almost everyone has taken hold of it and adapted it to their local musical traditions, yeah.
And now we have it here at the Proms. Thank you, Thomas. I'll let you sit back down. Time now, though, to hear from Kayo Chingonyi.
I thought I'd begin with some musical poems, and this first one, it might resonate with those of you who used to tape songs from the radio. It's called Guide to Proper Mixtape Assembly. The silence between songs cannot be modulated by anything other than held breath. You have to sit and wait. Time the release of the pause button to the last tenth of a second, so that the gap between each track is a smooth purr, a TDK or Memorex, your masterwork. Don't talk to me about your MP3 player. How, given the limitless choice, you hardly ever listen to one song for more than 2 minutes at a time. Do you know about stealing double A's from the TV remote so you can listen to last night's clandestine effort on the walk to school? You say you love music. Have you suffered the loss of a cassette so gnarled by a tape deck's teeth? It refuses to play the beat you've come to recognize by sound and not name. Have you carried that theme in your head all these years, in the faint hope you might know it when it finds you in a far-flung cafe as you stand to pay, frozen, and the barista has to ask if you're okay. This is called Some Bright Elegance, and it's for anyone who likes to go out dancing. For the screw-faced, in good shoes that paper the walls of dance halls, I have little patience. I say dance. Not to be seen but free, your feet are made for better things. Feel the bitterness in you lift as it did for a six-year-old Bojangles, tapping a living out of Richmond beer gardens to the delight of a crowd that wasn't lynching today, but laughing at the quickness of the kid. Throw yourself into the thick, emerging pure, reduced to flesh and bone, nerve and sinew. Your folded arms understand music. Imagine a packed Savoy ballroom and slide across the dusty floor as your zoot-suited 20s self. The feather in your hat from an ostrich, the swagger in your step from the ochre dust of a West African village. Dance for the times you've been stalked by store detectives, for a lady on a bus, for the look of disgust on the face of a boy too young to understand why he hates. Only that he must. Dance for Sammy, dead and penniless, and for the thousands still scraping a buck as street corner hoofers, who, though they dance for their food, move as if it is just them, and the drums talking. This is a poem called March 30th and imagines the day of a funeral. That day, in the same month I was born, your people milled around Keening in Luvali for the lofty man, Long John, the room of his chest. So many had been lifted and held to its deafening metrical foot, we'd begun to think it could never stop. We'd begun to think it could never stop. So many had been lifted and held to its deafening metrical foot. For the lofty man, Long John, the room of his chest, your people milled around Keening in Luvali. That day, in the same month, I was born. So I've always been fascinated by those people who used to write into newspapers, you know, the missed connection column in a newspaper. So in an effort to try and understand the kind of person who not so much strikes while the iron is hot, so much as strikes while the iron is broken beyond repair, I wrote this poem. You come into your own at train stations, after the fact, in the safe distance afforded those who remain behind. Stalled beside the point of action, brave enough to speak when the chances of failure and success recede. I was the man in houndstooth shoes you sat next to on the overground to Richmond at 2:05 on June 22nd. You wore a sundress and Ray-Bans, rims the shade of your lipstick. Drink? So many pages given over to this yen we have for laying ourselves open. So long as it won't end in brokenness. What we have to say of hope hinges within the particular details. Flight 551 from Mexico, seat 18C, the tallest of the Polish contingent. A palpable frisson in the queue at baggage claim. You know an unbidden compliment for what it is. You can be distinguished from your opportunist counterparts by your tendency to qualify. Where brasher paramours, drunk naturally, might blurt, you opt for poise. Since what works in a film tends to fall flat in print, I don't usually do this, but I was afraid you'd live your life not knowing what I'd give to know your name.
Music performed by Thomas Brangwyn, Adi Brostami and Mehdi Ganjvar at a Proms Plus Late event at the Royal Albert Hall last week. The poetry in the programme was written and read by Kayo Chingonyi, and the programme was introduced by Georgia Mann. And you can hear more from the Proms Plus Late events next Monday evening at 10 past 10 here on Radio 3. I wonder if you heard the American composer-pianist Frederick Zhevsky at last night's Late Prom playing his own piano concerto. Well, this is a piece of his called To the Earth, and the words are what Zhevsky calls a pseudo-Homeric hymn to the Earth Mother of All, probably written in the 7th century BC. And what could be more suitable as an accompaniment to a hymn to the Earth Mother than the clay of flower pots? The voice here and the percussionist is Evelyn Glennie.
Earth, mother of all, I will sing the well established. The oldest, who nourishes on her surface everything that lives. Those things that walk upon the holy ground, and those that swim in the sea, and those that fly. All these are nourished by your abundance. Thanks to you, if we humans have healthy children and rich harvests. Great Earth, you have the power to give life to and to take it away from creatures that must die. Happy are the ones whom you honor with your kindness and gifts. What they have built will not vanish. Are fertile, their herds prosper. And their houses are full of good things. Their cities are governed with just laws. Their women are beautiful. Good fortune and wealth Follow them. Children are radiant with the joy of youth. The young women play in the flowery meadows. Dancing with happiness in their hearts. Spirit, so it is with those whom you honor. Hail to you. Mother of life. Loved by the starry sky. Be generous and give me a happy life. In return for my song. So that I can continue to praise you with my music.
To the Earth, written in 1985 by the American Frederick Jevski, and the performer there, Evelyn Glennie. But if you came in a little way into that, you might have been wondering what the percussion instrument was she was playing. Well, the answer was for flower pots, and apparently it's not just a question of popping down to the nursery for any old flower pot. Jevski said some he tried were alive and others very dead, some emitting a disappointing thunk, while others, as he put it, burst into resonant song at the lightest touch. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone a quarter to 11. Well, now the essay. The dancer Akram Khan admits that he's a tough subject for any portrait painter. How does an artist capture the vitality, the tradition and the symbolism of Khan's performance? Well, concluding this essay series, here's Looking at Me. Khan explains how he and the American-Iranian artist Darvish Farr collaborated to produce a remarkable portrait.
Darvish Fakir's portrait of me is a square made up of 9 separate canvases. Each of those canvases is half a metre square and is a sepia painting of my upper body caught in the moment of striking a different pose, a gesture in dance. It came about because Sandy Nairn, artistic director of the National Portrait Gallery, and his colleague, a wonderful woman called Rosie Broadley, said they wanted a portrait and wanted to propose someone to work with me. We were hunting for quite a while. It didn't come straight away. Sandy's first proposal was Anthony Gormley. But Anthony had already made a life-size rubber cast of me for the dance piece called 0 Degrees. And it was interesting. I mean, it had broken down, like the body decaying. Bits of my cheeks had come off, but Sandy didn't like the idea of using that. Nor did I, actually. One of my first ambitions was to work with Steve McQueen, and there was a possibility, but due to time commitment, his and mine, well, it didn't happen. So, they proposed Darvish Fakir, and I went to see some of the work he'd already done, and was immediately attracted to it. I liked his transforming use of scale. I was struck by one picture in particular. The subject was a little girl looking up at herself, an 8-foot giant version of herself. It reminded me of Marvel Comics. Those comics are often based on real characters, but they're distorted to a point where they become surreal. I grew up on comic books, and I was attracted to this way of working, and so I wanted to get to know Darvish. He was invited to see a show. I was doing Sacred Monsters at the time with Sylvie Guillem, and we connected immediately. We said yes, that we would do something together. What followed was a long process, like a courtship. I thought it was very important that we were not rushed into it. I mean, I didn't want it to be an arranged marriage. It was important to get to know each other, which we did over a year and a half, maybe. The portrait gallery got a bit anxious, I think. Would they be just friends forever? Well, we did become friends. Darvish even participated in research for the dance piece called Bahok. He needed to experience the physical journey we take as dancers. To understand how choreography is made, you have to understand the mind of the choreographer, and of course that physicality is vital. I didn't want to separate the person Akram Khan from the dancer Akram Khan. I mean, it's not like I chose dance. I feel that dance chose me. So we decided early on that just to do a portrait of me sitting wasn't enough. It would be 9 or 12 panels, or 9 in 1, and all about movement. Also, for me, there are 3 elements to capturing a person in a portrait. There's the private person, so when you look in the mirror, you notice things that others wouldn't notice, what you consider to be your flaws. Secondly, there's the public perception, the way other people see you. And thirdly, there's the way you are. We wanted to bring the first and second together to get closer to the essence, the truth. So we had organized sessions where there was a space with sufficient light where I could just, well, improvise and just move. He filmed me and took a lot of photos, and he would just touch my head. It was as though he was mentally making a 3D image of my head, because he was fascinated by its structure, more so than the rest of the body. So when we had time, he would take some more photos in different scenarios, because what I'm here now is not what I'm in front of my parents, for example. And he wanted 360 degrees perspective of me. So sometimes we were in the studio, or in his flat, or on the road, or even in the office. He was also fascinated by the Navrasa, which means 9 sentiments, or emotions. It's a codified system in Kathak traditional dance that we use to evoke different feelings. They are love, laughter, fury, compassion, disgust, horror, heroism, wonder, and peace. He didn't follow them slavishly. In fact, he showed me 12 frames at first, and we didn't choose those that literally corresponded to the traditional poses. We chose the ones that were more abstract, more ambiguous. Because I think that's what you get in dance, that sense of abstraction. Each frame has me in the moment of moving, and the hands play a very big part. They're in different positions and hold different gestures, and they also interact with the clothes. There's a very rebellious one that's very clear, with me sticking up my finger with my head turned away from the viewer. This is like when I was a child growing up. I'm very close to my mother and very close to my guru, my master. They were my guides. But there comes a moment when you have to kill that relationship and find who you are, not what they want you to be. And any change is violent, and although it was very beautiful and graceful in my case, it was also violent. Putting my finger up, well, that was my way of saying, you have to let me go. I cannot be the perfect one. I have to be the rebel to find my voice, my own identity. There's even one where I confront myself, which is the tiger, where my hand is in a claw position and it's facing directly at me. I'm fascinated by breathing, by the concept of breath and water, and making movements as though the body is liquid. A flow of water, how it adapts to the container that you put it in, and yet it is so powerful. So there's one where I breathe into my wrists, and my hands are fanned out, like feathers. There's another one where my gesture is like an okay, with first finger connected with the thumb, but in a slightly awkward position, and that's how I feel when I look at myself. The body gets distorted somehow because of that awkwardness. There's one where I want to shut out the world. Silence and stillness are very important. So both my hands are clapped against my ears. I'm closing my eyes like I'm frustrated or in search of the inner world when the outer world is too overwhelming somehow. There's another one in a Buddha-like pose where I have first finger and thumb just at the top of my head. I mean, we were fascinated by the concept of Shiva, the third eye, except I placed it on top of the head. There's another one where I'm smelling my T-shirt, but the other hand is trying to move the hand that's holding the T-shirt up to my nose. This is about a sense of remembering, how the body is a memory bank, along with clothes and costumes. Everything that I and everybody carries with them is like a museum. We carry not only our experience from birth, but also our culture, our education, religion, and that of our parents and grandparents. It's all somewhere there. It's constantly transforming, but never goes away. Like a computer, you cannot completely delete material. The record of the past is always there. So, I think the portrait is both personal and universal. The gestures are about how I was feeling at the time, but are also inspired by tradition. You'd recognize those gestures from Kathak dance, but you're forced to look at them differently, in a more contemporary way. The panels are painted in sepia, which I like. Color would have given too much information. Color is so powerful and exerts so much psychological influence. Blue and green make us think differently. So it needed to be a bit more neutral, but black and white we thought was too straightforward, too cutthroat. But sepia was in between. I always wear black. That is me hiding my body. It's funny this, as I use my body to communicate, but it's the very thing I wanted to hide from close analysis. Black makes you look thinner. I was always afraid to wear bright colours. That's partly cultural, of course, partly religious. The way I was brought up, that you didn't show your body openly, but Darvish pushed me to wear white as well. So, in some of the panels, I'm in white, and not very comfortable. I'm comfortable wearing black, as I said. So there's a balance between comfort and discomfort. And also, it was to provoke me, to allow Darvish to see me in all types of guises. We both knew that. It's the same when I'm working with dancers or in the process of discovering characters. To really get to know them, you have to put them in extreme situations. For example, if I'm looking for the emotion of loss with a dancer, then I'll probe very personally into their memory and I wouldn't let them leave the room until I had opened them up a bit, broken the protective shell. And that happened to me several times in this portrait. It wasn't a struggle to get me to be vulnerable. If I was cold or super tired or in a bad mood, that's when he'd push me. Keep moving, he would say. I know you're tired, but just use that. It's not going to be a great portrait if you don't push. But There were lovely moments too, in the breaks. He would say, just meditate, close your eyes, and be still. And in those moments, I'd invariably just fall asleep. He would still be taking photos or sketching the structure of my head. That's how comfortable I felt with him. The painting started much later, though, once the research was done. I didn't want to have too much influence on that. I was afraid that it would then be about the way I wanted to be portrayed, the way I wanted people to see me, so I let go. I stepped out at that very moment. When I saw the finished painting, my first thought was, huh, it's not as powerful as I'd imagined. I think that was because the process had been so powerful. For me, it was a bit like cooking. The whole journey of cooking is far more fascinating than when you come to eat your own food. The whole business is heightened through smell, taste, and seeing the food. That's more imaginative than when it arrives on the plate. Actually, on the opening night, I didn't even look at the pictures. I was more interested in how people were looking at the portrait, observing the observers. They certainly asked a lot of questions, which is always a good sign. I think the portrait sums up my characteristics as a mover. How slow movement often shifts to extreme speed, and then midway through, there's stillness again, with no apparent logic. One of the things I talked to Darvish about was my fascination with Stravinsky. In The Rite of Spring, there's a sense of chaos, and yet with an underlying order to it, and an inherent sense of control, which I didn't understand. But that moment was transforming, not just for Diaghilev or Nijinsky, but Picasso as well. They were all breaking the classical forms, deconstructing to create something of their own. I think it's characteristic of my nature to be very alive in chaos, but a chaos underpinned by order, even if it's not immediately apparent. If there was going to be another portrait of me, well, I'd like to do it myself. I've always been more attracted to sculpture than to painting. I very much admire the spirituality and the science of the work of Anish Kapoor, for example. So I would make a cast of my own body from clay, harden it and cut it up, put it in different parts of the space, arranged in line like stars. So maybe you see a part of my head, but the other part of my head is a meter back, held by strings or even metal. And only when you come to a certain angle will the entirety of the figure line up. So to see a person in their true form, all those things have to come together. It has to be the right place at the right time. And then it happens only for a moment, brief moment, and then it passes you by. And that is what I would do. That's not to say that the collaboration with Darvish wasn't a marriage made in heaven. It was.
That was the dancer Akram Khan, whose portrait by Darvish Fakir is in the collection of the National Portrait Gallery. The series Here's Looking at Me was produced by Susan Marling and is a Just Radio production, first broadcast in May last year.
The Edinburgh Festival's 2013. On radio, on TV and online throughout August on the BBC. And on BBC Radio 3, daily Queen's Hall recitals from the Edinburgh International Festival itself.
One of Edinburgh's loveliest music venues.
The second of 3 weeks of amazing music making for mid-morning festival goers. Music from Edinburgh favourites and from stars of the future.
Coffee, a croissant and a concert, the order of the day.
Catch up with some of the concerts so far online at bbc.co.uk/radio3. And join us as we continue our coverage of the Edinburgh International Festival, weekday mornings at 11 o'clock.
And tomorrow morning, the period instrument group Les Talents Lyriques in a wide-ranging selection of music by François Couperin. That's at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. 11 o'clock this Tuesday evening, and now we join Max Reinhardt for Late Junction.
Thank you, Jonathan. Well, it's always good to hear musicians that refuse to lie down in the box they're put in for marketing purposes. The Unthanks were always so restless that they couldn't even decide what to call themselves. This is from their second album, The Bairns, released 6 years ago when they were called Rachel Unthank and the Winterset. It starts with a traditional lullaby and ends with endless delight, Newcastle Lullaby.
Sleep, Bonnie, Benny, behind the castle.
Sleep, Bonnie, Benny, behind the castle.
By love, shall have
a golden apple.
I'm trying hard to forget.
Newcastle Lullaby by Rachel Unthank and The Winterset. Welcome to Lake Junction. Tonight we've got some baroque, some vintage music from Joe Liggins and Mike Cooper, a cappella involving hot gospel and Sanskrit text, a song from Richard Thompson and one from his daughter. You know the kind of thing. You can share your thoughts with us on this hot summer's night with, I think, a full moon. You can tweet at BBC Radio 3, email lake.junction@bbc.co.uk. Leta Mbulu was in a swing vocal group, The Skylarks, with Miriam Makeba back in the days of Soweto. She left South Africa with the musical King Kong along with Miriam Makeba and Hugh Masekela at the end of the 50s and escaped apartheid. In the USA, she got involved with the jazz scene, including Cannonball Adderley and Nat. And this South African classic, Noma Temba, was recorded with Cannonball Adderley for an album that they made in 1973 for her new album, The Fantasy Label. For a new label, I should say, Fantasy. The album's called Naturally, and the track, as I said, Noma Temba.